Hi, I'm Yoshi Silverstein, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. And this is a reminder to bring your body with you wherever you go.
Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
You know, I am really, really excited about the next few Torah portions that are coming up.
Really? Why? I mean, all the exciting stuff has already happened with the, like, miracles and stuff.
Not for me. I'm a planner. I really love the idea of thinking up something beautiful that's going to come down the pike.
Okay. I guess we're going to talk about things that are going to happen?
Yeah, kind of. But I mean, like, think about it this way. Think about it here. Imagine, if you will. Every new year, I love starting a new planner because I get to look ahead and see what's going to happen and then get to kind of draw it out. I mean, you're an artist. You know what it's like to sketch out a really beautiful idea and then watch it come to fruition, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the whole point.
And when you get feedback, does that make your plan better?
Usually, yeah.
Okay, so one of the really beautiful things that's going to happen in the next few weeks is we're going to have some plans and we're going to have a lot of community participation.
Sounds great to me.
I think so, too. And I'm really, really excited for our guest tonight, who's going to talk about how we can actually embody those values.
All right.
All right. Let's get started.
Let's go.
They say that every good goal starts with a plan, and our Torah is really no different. In trying to figure out what we're going to do next, or the community that we're trying to build, we are looking to create a blueprint. And in this week's portion, we're dealing a lot with plans and blueprints of buildings, but also trying to understand how each person can play a part. And so I'm really excited that this week we are dealing in Parshat Terumah. Now, Terumah is a weird word that we'll talk about a little later. I'm sure Gabe discusses it in his distilled Parsha summary. But for now, I'm really excited to have someone who's going to help explain why having the entire community play a part in building the world that we live in and building sacred spaces is super important. It is my pleasure and my privilege to welcome Yoshi Silverstein. Yoshi Silverstein, he/him, is founder and executive director of Mitsui Collective, a Chinese Ashkenazi American Jew and a multidisciplinary practitioner of embodied creative expression, spiritual exploration, and somatic anti-racism. Yoshi is a recipient of the 2022 Pomegranate Prize for Emerging Leaders in Jewish Education from the Covenant Foundation and was selected as a 2021 GRIST 50 Fixer, Building a More Just and Equitable Future. He also sits on the board of directors for Repair the World and has taught in faculty roles at Jewish institutions, including Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, M Squared Institute for Experiential Jewish Education, Institute for Jewish Spirituality, and Avodah's Institute for Social Change. Yoshi earned his master's degree in landscape architecture at University of Maryland with a thesis exploring Jewish landscape journey and experience, holds certificates in spiritual entrepreneurship, social entrepreneurship, permaculture design, and environmental education, and can't stay away from a good Jewish fellowship. Yoshi, I'm really looking forward to when we overlap with the next one. He holds a second-degree black belt in Lotus Kaju Kenbo, a white belt in Shuai Jiao Kung Fu, and is an avid aficionado of Chinese roast duck. Yoshi lives in the Cleveland area in Shaker Heights, Ohio, on Erie, Mississauga, and Haudenosaunee land with his wife and daughter. Yoshi, we're so thrilled to welcome you to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
It is a delight to have you here. Gabe, I am so excited for you to meet my new friend who I got to speak with for the first time while driving from Washington to New York. And it was such a good conversation that I got distracted and lost. But that's not really surprising to you, who knows my directional, you know, dyslexia and issues. But Gabe, as somebody who helps guide me along my path and my journey, hello, my friend. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. I'm glad we all found our way here.
Of course. And it wouldn't be me telling a story about my difficulty with directions if I didn't bring up executive producer Idan Waldman, who lovingly put on the transit app when I moved to New York City so that I would be able to find my way around. So Idan Waldman, thank you for A, keeping me alive and on time, and B, how you doing tonight, buddy?
Doing great. It's much, my day's been made much better by being here with all of you.
Incredible. I am so glad to be on this journey and to be planning out this episode for this Parsha with all three of you. And I think we're ready to get started and maybe even start building. Hey, Gabe.
Hey, Amanda.
I've been thinking.
That's sometimes dangerous. What's going on?
Well, okay. I wouldn't say that I, like, angle for presents, but you told me that I was getting a Hanukkah present a while ago, and...
Okay, listen, listen. No, this isn't fair. I ordered the gift in November. It has been, I've been tracking it every day on the USPS app. I've been tracking it every day. It has said that it's been at customs at JFK for since December 31st. It took a while to get there. Took longer than it was expected. It said shipping 3 to 4 weeks. It's been months. I'm only a little mad about it. And the worst part is that it's in the city. Like, I could drive there right now and go get it, but not really because they wouldn't, you know, let me because it's in customs. Anyway, why do you bring up your Hanukkah present that hasn't arrived yet?
Okay, so I know that some people, when they throw parties, they say no presents, but your presents. But in this particular parsha, like, God's asking for gifts. And so I was curious if you could kind of dole out some information on that.
Absolutely. God tells Moses to get the people to bring gifts of gold, silver, copper, blue yarn, purple yarn, crimson yarn, linen, goat hair, ram skin, dolphin skin, wood, oil, spices, incense, and gems. Wait, did you just say dolphin skins? I did, in fact, say dolphin skins. Anyway, God has some very specific instructions on how to build this dwelling place, complete with materials and exact dimensions. There's a wooden ark that's 2.5 cubits long and 1.5 cubits wide and 1.5 cubits tall, overlaid with gold inside and out, and also some gold moldings and some rings and feet and wooden poles, also overlaid with gold. The ark is for the tablets, so that's cool, I guess. What else? A cover of pure gold, 2.5 by 1.5 cubits, with golden hammered cherubim facing each other with their wings shielding the cover. Put the cover on the ark, the tablets are in the ark, and then it's covered with the cover. Oh, we need some bowls and ladles and jars and jugs, also gold. If you ask me, God's house is getting a bit gaudy. Get it? Get it, Manda? Gaudy? What's that? It's a menorah, also gold, with 3 branches on either side with cups shaped like almond blossoms. Are we done yet? Not even a little bit. God wants a tabernacle made of 10 strips of fine twisted linen, the blue, purple, and crimson yarns, and also there should be some nice cherub designs. The dimensions of each cloth are 28 by 4 cubits, and they should be joined together in groups of 5. Also, there should be 50 loops of blue wool on each set, because obviously what's a tabernacle without blue wool loops? The whole thing is held together by 50 gold clasps. And another covering, this one of 11 cloths of goat hair, 30 by 4 cubits, this time with copper clasps. Also, there's a tent covering of tanned ram skins and dolphin skins. Hey Gabe, what's this dolphin skins thing again? Don't worry about it. The walls are wooden planks, each 10 by 1.5 cubits. There are 20 of these on the south side, with 40 silver sockets, and 20 on the north, with another 40 sockets and 6 to the west. Also, some wooden bars, 5 for each side. Oh, and overlay all of those with gold while you're at it. And a curtain, blue, purple, and crimson yarns with fine linen and the all-important cherubim. This is hung on 4 wooden poles overlaid with gold hooks, set into silver sockets. Then we get some nice interior decorating with the ark behind the curtain and the menorah on the south side opposite the table with all the vessels to the north. I'm getting a little tired of describing all of these things, so here's a quick rundown of the rest of the things we need. Just assume that all of them have very specific and mildly confusing instructions. A screen for the entrance, an altar with horns, some copper buckets and other utensils, some cloth hangings for the walls, some posts, more sockets, more utensils, and some pegs. And that's Parashat Terumah.
Woo! That is a lot. That is very specific.
there are times that you want Torah to be more specific. You're like, wait, well, what do you mean by that? Like, you want a little more specificity. You want some clarification. This is, I think, maybe one of the few times in Torah I'm like, you can calm down a little bit. Like, we didn't need all of this. We didn't need you to give the full blueprints. We could have figured this out.
It also makes me wonder, like, is narrative the best form for laying all this out? Like, maybe you should have just gone to some like actual blueprints, right? Of like schematics and labeling drawings. I feel like maybe that would have been a more, you know, convenient or efficient way to communicate these clearly very important instructions.
Well, I'm not sure the authors of the Torah had efficiency in mind at any point in time, but that's a fair point.
Yoshi, before we get started, I just want to say again, thank you so much for keeping me company on my car ride. Totally worth a misturn.
To the getting slightly lost and then found. I mean, one way we could think of like all of Judaism is basically a continual process of asking like, where and when actually are we? And so we talk a lot about like orienting to the Jewish space-time continuum in our work. And so I feel like that's just like a microcosm of sometimes we get lost, but then we just sort of orient and figure out where we are again and when we are and jump back in.
Amazing. I really appreciate that perspective of being able to reorient ourselves. And so I have to ask, what gave you your direction and inspires you to do the work that you're doing, especially with the Mitsui Collective?
So I think pretty much from like when I was a child, I started to experience the world using my body. So I went to my parents, I should say, put me into Montessori preschool that was housed in an arboretum. So recess was basically go play in the trees, children, and don't kill yourselves and, you know, see you when you come back. I got involved also then at a young age in playing music and doing martial arts, spending, you know, again, time in nature, also, you know, a lot of hiking, camping, skiing, etc. So all of these things that as I look back on them have this connective fabric of embodiment, but which is to say experiencing the world through our bodies, right, is like one way to think of what is embodiment. It is experiencing through the body. And I don't know about you all, but I haven't figured out how to not take my body with me everywhere I go. So we are all experiencing the world first and foremost through the body. The body is that first gateway. And then everything that goes through the body, the sensory inputs that we're taking in, the way we're responding, then it starts to go into these other layers of emotional sensation, social connection, like intellectualizing, you know, spiritual connection somewhere in there. So as I got older, I started to get more and more involved Jewishly and started to explore things through a Jewish lens or through Jewish frameworks. And I discovered that there was all sorts of just added meaning and depth and rootedness when I did that. And so sort of in a lot of different ways, that's been sort of this guiding framework of, you know, I feel like a lot of Jewish educators are like, what does this thing look like? But Jewish. And so, you know, I think for me, in terms of sort of the passions and the work that we do now with Mitsui Collective, which is about Jewish embodiment, it's one about experiencing things through the body. But there's also this meta sort of layer of what does it mean to embody something? And that's where we sort of really get into, okay, what are our modern contemporary Jewish values, ethics, ideals, particularly for those of us who are looking at things through a more, you know, progressive lens. And we're looking at things through maybe a liberatory framework, anti-racist framework, counter-oppression, right? We're really trying to, you know, change the world for the better, fix the world, right? Go through this process of tikkun olam. It's really easy for those things to sit at this sort of like abstract theoretical level, right? We have these values, but they're kind of floating up here, right? How do we actually take those and bring them into not just the theory, realm of theory, but into how we're actually moving through the world, right? Ingraining them in our actions, our behaviors, our habits. That's embodiment, right? So that's really the passion that I have is sort of how do we bridge the gaps between those values and ethics and ideals, and then how we're actually acting in accordance with them in the world. And then how do we cultivate the practices that allow us to develop more skill and capacity in being able to more fully embody the things that we say that we hold dear and that we're really striving to work towards.
When I hear the term embody, I get almost a little bit uncomfortable. And the reason I get a little uncomfortable is that I'm somebody who's not always been super comfortable or confident with my body, with how I look, with how I feel walking through the world. You know, I never liked to dance in groups because at school dances or wherever, because I felt like I was awkward and people were watching me and I don't know what to do with my hands. And so this idea of like embodiment, this idea of embodying, of like really focusing on my body is like, that's the opposite of what I want to do. And I know that that's just like my own, you know, confidence or anxieties that like are things that I can work on myself. But for a lot of people, there are a lot of ways in which the idea of focusing on the body can be uncomfortable, can be challenging, whether due to dysmorphia or simply due to not being confident or comfortable. So I'm curious, in this kind of open, progressive space that you're creating with the Mitsui Collective, how are you kind of leaning into the embodiment and also kind of respecting and working with those people who might not be so comfortable with the idea of embodiment at first?
Yeah, I love that question. I think I have a three-part answer, but don't hold me strictly to the three. So the first part, I mean, I think is we in the big general Jewish we, right? Which, you know, is a bold assumption for me to make that we can actually say that, but we often do. Like, Jews are known as the people of the book, right? And so for probably a lot of different reasons, which I don't know, maybe we'll dig into later, but there's been all sorts of ways in which we have deprioritized, maybe disconnected from other sources of knowledge, wisdom, experience. And part of what that has done is it has, I would say, overemphasized the written word as the only form of legitimate knowledge, as opposed to one important form. It has driven that up. Again, it's disconnected us from our bodies. It's also sort of, I mean, it's all mixed into different sort of, you know, anti-Semitism, right? Internalized anti-Semitism, like all sorts of things are woven in there. My dear friend and colleague, Kohenet Kishira Halev Fife, has a really nice framework that I like to cite when thinking about this. So she says, yes, we are people of the book. We are also a people of the body and a people of the earth. And so there's wisdom that comes from all three of those sources. So Torah of like the scrolls, text of Torah, right? But also there's Torah of when we connect to the earth, right? Contains deep Torah sort of, you know, wisdom and learning, and the same thing for the body. So that's number one. Number two is that it's really important for us to be looking not only at how do we experience Jewish life and learning through the body, and that's where we use different sort of embodied practices or modalities of movement and breathwork and song and nature connection. So those are embodied modalities. Those allow us to experience Jewish life and learning through the body. And it's really important that we're also looking at what are the ways in which our experience of Jewish life and learning in Jewish community are impacted because of the bodies that we're in. And so whether that be different ways that we feel at home or not at home in our bodies, right? Like, do we feel athletic or not? Like, how big is our body relative to social norms? Like, you know, racialized identity is one of our particular areas where we really focus on that, right? How does it impact the way that I move through a space and the way I'm seen in a space because of my racialized identity, which is not exclusively the sort of physical aspects of my body, but it's a lot that in terms of how we get racialized, right? So that's number two, is like those are all really important things for us to be aware of and attuning to and then working and navigating to ultimately build just like stronger, better, healthier culture around the ways that create access points for all of us to be more fully in our bodies. Number three, and this is going to tie in very directly with the Parsha Truma that we're looking at this week. So this might be the very first time I have uttered the phrase I'm about to say in a professional context, because I don't actually like it, which is why I don't use it. But I'm gonna reference it so that I can like maybe deconstruct a little bit. So especially in these, you know, embodiment, movement, wellness, self-care spaces, there's this refrain of your body is a temple. Now, it's pretty apt because we are talking about the Mishkan, which is like the original temple, more or less, right? So like, there's something to dig into there. And I think that there's ways in which that is very unhelpful, right? And leads us down very sort of narrow, pun intended. Mitzrayim, Egypt is like the narrows, and, you know, in the wilderness, we're moving out of the narrows. Anyway, that's a very insider level pun. Anyway, there's ways in which that's narrowing and the ways in which that's sort of opening up, right? So the ways in which that's narrowing, let's start there, is like your body is a temple. Like that gets sort of co-opted into this thing where we go from sort of like space of just good, healthy kind of stuff of like, yeah, eat nutritious foods, right? That are gonna nourish us, give us the nutrients we need to go about life, blah, blah, blah. Like, we need to get movement. We need to spend time with loved ones. We need to, but like, yeah, we need to take care of ourselves, right? But that gets co-opted into this sort of like puritanical version where it's like a hyper purity, right? In terms of like, it goes to this place where like the only things that I can put in my body are the most impossibly pure substances, blah, 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 right? That are actually completely unrealistic, you know, and also not even necessarily healthy, right? So like that's one way. Also, that leads, by the way, very directly into like purity of what's going into my body, purity of my body, which bodies are more pure than others. Like, spoiler alert, it's pretty easy for that to lead into, oh, white bodies. So this all compounds in different ways, right? So my body is a temple. That's a way in which that is a very unhelpful thing. And we're actually making an idol of the body, right? So also tie into, I don't know, a few parshot ago of the golden calf, right? Which took all of these same materials that we were talking about that contribute to the building of the Mishkan, but turned them into an idol of the calf, right? And that was clearly a no-no, right? Like, that was idol worship. No, bad, right? So that's the way that your body is a temple is really, really, really unhelpful. And that's why I, like, up until now, like, never say that phrase. But the way that it actually could be helpful is like, okay, let's look now at the Mishkan, which is this sacred dwelling space that we just heard these like very exhaustive instructions on the construction and the materials and all of that, right? But the key word is it's a space, right? It's not a thing in the same way that the calf was a thing. It is building a space around something. And so that is, and it's meant as a dwelling place for God, right? And so, of course, that leads us all to questions of like, well, God's everywhere. Why does God need a dwelling place? And like all of that. So maybe we'll get more into that. But I think as we bring that into, okay, what does it mean for our body to be a Mishkan? It means that our body is a dwelling place for the divine. And we hear in, you know, some of the first verses of Genesis or in chapter one that we are created, we all humans are created B'Tselem Elohim in the divine image, right? And so what does it mean for us to have that core innate divinity? I think for our bodies to be a Mishkan, sometimes I talk about this of our bodies being like a sukkah, and there's parallels between the sukkah and the Mishkan, right? Both of these are these like temporary dwelling spaces. And the sukkah, we dwell in the sukkah. And we actually say the blessing, Lashev Basukkah, which means to dwell in the sukkah. And so we activate the sukkah when we are dwelling in it. Like that's when we say the blessing. And I think it's the same for the Mishkan, right? The activation of that space is some form of God dwelling in it. And so for us to think about what does it mean to cultivate that in the body, it's saying, what does it mean to activate ourselves with this innate core divinity? Maybe that's the soul, right? Maybe that's just, which is like this spark of the divine that lives inside of us, but it lives inside each and every one of us. And so for that, I think about what is the experience of this life that through my body, I'm giving that spark of the divine that's living inside of me that is unique from every other human that is or ever will be and was like born and lived on this earth, that God is having billions and billions, maybe trillions eventually, of these human experiences that even though God is omniscient, omnipresent, et cetera, is that somehow important for God to have those experiences. So that's what I think about, like, what experience am I giving my divine soul in this one and only lifetime that I have?
You know, it's interesting that you bring up this idea of creation, and I'm reminded of how there's this midrash, there's this commentary, this idea on Genesis 3, where we have the first humans, Adam and Eve, if you want to call them that, banished from the garden. And as they're being banished, that is when God says, I'm going to make you katnut, or I'm going to make you tunics of skin, clothing of skin, garments of skin. And it's not entirely clear what that means, because it could be, or could be the skin of a human, or it could also be an animal hide.
Like a dolphin.
Like a dolphin. It's a different word, but it absolutely could be. You know, it could have been dolphin skins. But there's this idea that humans were actually not embodied in the garden, that we were somehow transcendent in the garden, and that once we were banished, we had to be clothed in skin. We had to become embodied in some way. And so in some ways, that makes me believe that, okay, well, maybe this embodiment is a bit of a curse. It's a bit of something we shouldn't like very much. And yet at the same time, I'm thinking about how, except the experience of this world necessitates that embodiment. We cannot experience this world without that embodiment.
It's so interesting. I think that when we have, at least in my experience, when I think about deeply embodied experiences, they're almost paradoxical. Because on the one hand, there are these experiences that bring me deeply into my body, into the sensations of my body, into presence with what's around me. You know, maybe if we're, say, like in a song circle, like with the song and the rhythms and vibrations and resonance with like all the bodies that are around me. So it's like, that's all happening through the body. And there's also this sort of expansive, transcendent experience as well, in which I feel like I am bigger than my body, bigger than myself. I've like transcended that in some way, right? And so what that makes me think about is hopefully all of us have had some type of that experience at some point in our lives. Maybe often, maybe just once, I don't know, right? But like that is a very deep, meaningful, purposeful, spiritual experience to have, right? Those kinds of transcendent moments. And so when I think about the verses that you're citing, I mean, I in general, with a lot of the Torah, but particularly with the story of God and Eden, of the Garden of Eden and the expulsion and all of that, I find it helpful to read that story not only as a proscriptive story, meaning like, if you do X, then Y will happen, right? Which is a sort of like, we got cursed because we did this thing, right? Yes, there's that reading, but there's also a descriptive reading in which we are describing what did happen. And so if we have this experience where we have both the feeling of expansive transcendence, of like not having physical bodies, right? And so on the one hand, we're like, well, we know that that is an experience we can have. So that must have happened somewhere. And yet here we are, these, you know, bags of bones and flesh, right? So it's like, well, like what's going on there? And so maybe part of that is like a description of like, here's how that happened, right? How we went from these sort of like transcendent, you know, beings not limited by body into these beings that are limited by body. And then by the way, also like, why do we have to toil so hard to grow our food, right? And why is childbirth such a painful and laborious experience? And, right? It's like these things that we know are part of our existence today, and then describing like, well, here's how this may have sort of like, you know, happened. And this is our, I mean, it's our mythology, right? For like how all of that came to be.
So I really appreciate your take on the idea that our bodies being a type of Mishkan might be a dwelling place for God. That was really breathtaking for me in a moment where I was like, wow, which doesn't always happen. But I'm really, I want to just say, A, thank you for that teaching, because that was, as I said, very meaningful for me and really took my breath away. I was thinking, so I focus on Truma a lot, and I always like focusing on the gifts part, not just because like I like receiving gifts, but actually because like gift giving is my love language and something that's always been really special for me. And I wanted to actually go outside my comfort zone and ask you a really important question, I think. I think, look, Truma does say, you know, everyone should give whose heart is open to it. And in some ways that makes us, it's a great equalizer, right? That everybody's able to give according to what they can. But I also was thinking about what is supposed to be inside this tabernacle, what is supposed to be inside this temple, this Mishkan. And that one of the things that we talk about is called Ha'edut, which is the path or the Ten Commandments, or but also comes from this word for witnessing, ha'edah, this idea of edut or edot can be witnesses. Edim actually generally is witnesses if they're just doing a normal plural, but that's Hebrew grammar and who cares? All of which is to say that there's something about this that's really important, that this will be witnessed. There is something holy in this path. There is something important to the witnessing of this being done. And I'm thinking about the anti-racism work you engage with, and I'm thinking about the community that is needed to come together to work towards something holy, to create something that will be witnessed, and how these things might change when someone or something is watching, when there's something to say, like, this is going to be a part of our history and we are recording it.
There's a lot of levels in that your question is making me think about. So one is a tie-in that is also one of my favorite tie-ins, sort of, intertextual commentaries from Genesis to whatever book we're in now for Truma. So I mentioned earlier that there's a line of we humans were created, B'Tselem Elohim, in the divine image, B'Tselem Elohim. And now as we're looking at the building of the Mishkan, there's a guy named Bezalel, and he's usually attributed as like, he is the architect designer of the Mishkan. And again, there's different ways, of course, because it's Torah, there's 1,000 different ways to read everything. So one of my favorite different interpretations of who is Bezalel is that we often think of Bezalel as a single individual person. But there's a different reading of Bezalel, which is actually, it's a contraction for Bezalel Elohim. So Bezalel is not one person. Bezalel is the embodied manifestation of our innate divineness that comes together to build the Mishkan, to design and build the Mishkan. So one, that's just this like overarching tie-in of there's a role for all of us. And like we bring ourselves to the community. And just by doing that, we are building Mishkan. We are building holy dwelling space for the divine. And so I think that means that one, we all have different gifts to bring, right? And so that brings me a bit to then the part of the edut, this sort of witnessing aspect. So one is with anti-racism work, both broadly and then specifically the somatic anti-racism work that we do, and somatic meaning how we really bring this work into the body, and thinking about somatic referring to sort of all of the layers of self, so physical as well as the intellectual and emotional and spiritual senses of self. So when we're bringing this into somatic anti-racism, one of the first and really core, like foundational skill sets to develop is awareness, is cultivating awareness of what is happening in our bodies, what is happening in other people's bodies, what's happening between our bodies. And that awareness is critical, because if we're not aware of that, if we're not witnessing what's happening in ourselves and in others, then how are we going to do anything differently, right? That awareness is the first level. We have awareness. We have then attunement, which is sort of, attuning, right? Tuning up our ability to be more and more aware, our sort of sensitivity and being able to really recognize all of the different dimensions of what's happening, all of that. Right? And then we get to this piece of discernment, which is like, okay, what do I actually do with this? And then we can, and then we continue on from there in terms of, what do we do? So I think with all of that, this goes back to just the ways in which our modern society really creates a lot of disconnection between our quote unquote brains and bodies. Of course, the brain is inside the body. So like, that's a totally false, distinction, but that's how we talk about things. But we do have this like really overwhelming aspect in our society of disconnection from the body. And so just that process of increasing our awareness and our capacity to be aware of what's happening in the body is really important. And that is actually like, that is in its own way how we embody anti-racism, right? Is to become more aware of our bodies. And then I think there's this other layer that I think maybe you were sort of hinting at, but maybe not. But I think of, you were talking about like watching and recording. And so at least what that brought to mind for me is the role that literally digitally recording all of these sort of really horrific acts of racialized violence over the last many years in particular, like our ability to A, be witnesses and put ourselves in the role of witnesses, and then also actually be able to record and document those, the way that that has then shaped what happens after, right? And how those incidences are spread, how that creates more awareness, right? That hopefully leads to action. Of course, we all want it to be more action, but right, that's, so I think there's really something really interesting in that. And it's, again, I mean, there's a lot of layers to embodiment, right? I think this speaks to me of the layer of just, are we paying attention to what's happening inside us and around us, right? And it's pretty easy to go through a lot of life not paying very much attention. And I'd say actually, again, a lot of our modern world kind of tries to incentivize not paying very much attention, right? To numb out to everything that's happening in the world because it's really difficult and challenging, right? And certain people maybe benefit from us not paying too much attention to, you know, the systems of oppression and exploitation and marginalization that are happening all around us.
Thank you so much for such an honest answer. I'm curious. It's really interesting. So I think probably, I was hinting at maybe the digital recording, but I think that like there's something to be said about like, oh, this actually inspires me. And, you know, in talking about the anti-racism work about like, wow, like kind of having these systems of oppression being brought down or being transformed into something that we're able to face or change or make meaning from. And I do think in our tour, we do that in a really surprising way, especially when we're talking about the Mishkan, the tabernacle, because Gabe read before, it's supposed to be totally overlaid in gold, right? Everything is supposed to be overlaid in gold and silver. And here's the cool part about that we don't talk about. You ready? Insider baseball. I don't play, but let's go. The gold, the silver, all the things that are used like for the tabernacle all came from the gold and silver jewelry that we quote borrowed end quote from the Egyptians. It's okay. God told us to, so we're good, right? Maybe. But we use these symbols of oppression and create something holy with them in a really powerful way. And so I'm bringing this to you because I'm thinking about this. And I told you when I read your bio, I was like, oh my goodness, I have so many questions for you. But one of them is, you know, you have worked on social entrepreneurship and spiritual entrepreneurship. And I'm curious how our tabernacle, how our Mishkan can be an example of what happens when those things come into play together.
So I mentioned the golden calf earlier, which again, made from those exact same, all of the gold, silver, et cetera, that we borrowed from the Egyptians. It was a resource redistribution. So after several hundred years, right, of enslavement, part of what I think that story is telling us is it's not so easy. You can't just flip the switch, right, in then being able to be free, right? Like the body, right? If you're coming from however many generations of enslaved people, that's what your body knows, right? And in general, the whole, the entire process of spending 40 years in the desert, and this is really sad, it's tragic, right? But it's sort of like that generation did not know how to be free. To me, that's not really, it's not really an intellectualized knowing, because, you know, the people could learn the theory of being free. Like, I don't think it'd take 40 years to learn the theory of how to be a free people, right? But to really know that in your body, that takes decades. And in this case, maybe actually just a new generation that was born into freedom because that's what they knew in their bodies. And so the golden calf is, I think, a particular sort of micro representation of that, of doing what we knew, right? We sort of like went back to, well, our Egyptian slave masters, they built idols, like that's like we're trying to grip onto some tangible connection to divine something, we'll build an idol. Clearly, that was like the wrong direction. And so I think then the connection to entrepreneurship, whether it be social entrepreneurship, spiritual entrepreneurship, is what is entrepreneurship but like building something new, building something that creates new possibilities, that creates the space for new possibilities to happen, right? And it's really hard because we tend to build what we know, right? Even when we know all of the weaknesses that something has, right? It's really hard to break out of that because that's what we know. And so I think that the building of the Mishkan, yeah, it's this like entrepreneurial act of, you know, and it feels a little funny too, because it's like this entrepreneurial act of innovation, you know, but it's, you know, which is, I don't know, sometimes I find myself also getting a little frustrated with the way that we have sort of like, you know, I don't know, techie speak that makes it way into the world of spirituality. I don't know. But anyway, it is what it is. Again, well, we have deficits of language. We have the language we have, and we don't have the language we don't have, and, you know, working on creating new language. Anyway, so I think that's one of the possible connections to me is we were doing something that was really new in the world, right? We had this movement of this liberatory movement of, right, becoming a free people. And I don't know that that had happened in the world yet at that point, right? And so part of what we then did, like that whole act was just sort of like this like entrepreneurial venture, right? And then I think definitely like the building of the Mishkan, both in a pretty literal way, but also in a metaphorical, symbolical way, is this like act of spiritual entrepreneurship.
When I was a counselor at a day camp, we had this activity that we would do with all of our new groups where we would take a piece of paper and we would draw a heart on it. And then we would pass the paper around the group. And we did this with all age groups. I usually worked with second and third graders. So I would have each kid say something that somebody did that was mean to them at some point in their lives. And so, you know, first kid would get it, my brother called me a name I didn't like. And then they would fold down the paper in some way. They could fold down a corner, they could fold the whole piece of paper, they could crinkle it up however they wanted to do it. And it would go all the way around. And then I would say, okay, and now we're each going to say something that somebody did for us that made us feel good, that made us happy. And we passed it around and every person got to uncrinkle the paper a little bit. And no matter how many times you go around the circle, you never really get to uncrinkle the paper fully. It's never going back to its original state. And so the gist of it was, you know, don't crinkle people's hearts because those scars remain. What I'm kind of hearing from what you're saying about this generation that didn't know how to be free and having to like relearn how to do that is that A, there are people whose hearts are always going to be crinkled. You're never going to rid yourself of that trauma. And also, we know, and we know this very well in the Jewish community across all different kinds of Jews with all different assemblages of identities, we know that inherited trauma is a thing that exists. And so as much as I, you know, really love this idea of, you know, we kind of needed to get a generation beyond so that we could know how to be free, we know that that's something that really we all still strive for, that we're not all there yet, that we're all constantly learning and pushing on how to be free, whether that means how to best feel free and comfortable within our bodies or with other people or in our communities or with our identities. And so I'm curious, and if it relates to this idea of learning to be free, amazing. If it doesn't, fine. But because we do need to move on to our next section, if you had a message or a call to action or a piece of advice that you wanted to leave listeners with, what's your last little tidbit? What's your call to action? What's your statement?
Okay, so number one, I love that activity of the folding paper with hearts and everything. And that reminds me of some wisdom from our rabbi and sage, Leonard Cohen. May his memory be blessing. And we're talking about gift giving with Parshat Truma, right? So Leonard Cohen tells us, forget your perfect offering. Just bring the gifts that you can bring. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. So we are broken, beautiful, imperfect beings. And yeah, we are, part of us are that new generation born into greater freedom, I hope. But we are also the prior generation. And we're also like in Mitzrayim and like all of these things, like we are all of that. And I think that something that I've learned about intergenerational trauma and healing is that, so intergenerational trauma is trauma that passes from one generation to the next. So a person who experiences trauma in their lifetime and then is suffering from basically PTSD of some sort, right? If that trauma goes unhealed, then the impacts and subsequent behaviors of that trauma pass from one generation to the next. And so you can be several generations down and you have people who didn't experience the original trauma, but are acting and behaving as though they had, right? So that gets sort of ingrained in our genetic expression. So, but the scientific study of epigenetic transmission of trauma, that there is like current modern science that is really digging into that. And it's really, really fascinating. So there is that, that is scientific ways of knowing. The next part that I'm about to say is like, I don't know if we could ever scientifically measure this thing. So this gets into a more spiritual aspect, but there's also this idea. One is that we can go through the healing process for ourselves, healing the trauma that we have received. That part is, you know, more or less scientific, right? But there's this idea that we can also heal not only, and the more that we heal, the more that the generations that descend from us will be more healed. So, right, that all fits in a linear progression of time, right? But there's this idea that we can also heal backwards in time, and that when we heal ourselves, we're sending that healing back through prior generations, right, to be more healed. That this is a very spiritual, esoteric, right, like idea. But I think it's also a deeply Jewish idea, because the conception of Jewish time is not purely linear. Like, it doesn't just go in one straight line with one direction. It's actually spirolinear. It is a combination of linear and cyclical. It moves in a spiral. And we know that it has the cyclical nature because we cycle through all of the holidays every single year, right? We cycle through all of the Torah every single year and come back to Parsha again and again and again. So we cycle through, but it's not a purely cyclical. It sort of also does have a linear progression through time. And so if we think about what does that mean to have that spiral, and if we can envision that, you know, as we're listening to this, like, what does that look like for a spiral? It means that as you are moving along that spiral, that you have these sort of like wormholes from one point on the spiral to that same point exactly 1 year prior. And then again, 1 year prior. Like, if we were looking at this purely linearly, it would take 365 days to walk backwards through the spiral on that spiral line. I hope this is making sense without like any visuals, right? If you go through a wormhole, it doesn't take 365 days. You create this direct connection straight to the point last year or whatever prior point in time. And so every time we, like, I mean, there is so much about Jewish practice that is about marking time. I mean, basically all of our holidays have some aspect of that, and connecting back to all of these points in time that can align along this spiral. So I think that if we think about all of the work that we are doing in our own lives and today, we are creating these like wormholes that like send that healing backwards and forwards and through time. And it also allows us to tap into the experiences our people have had, both Jewish ancestors and for all of us who have non-Jewish ancestors as well. It allows us to tap into that. It allows us to tap into the resource. It allows us to connect to this expansive, non-linear conception of orienting to the Jewish space-time continuum. Bring it back around to that, of orienting to presence in this moment, but also like every single moment, past, present, and future.
This week on Midrashic Mixology for Parashat Teruma, we have the Tabernacle with a Twist. Start off your drink building with 2 cubits, nope, I mean 2 ounces of bourbon in a shaker. Add in 1 ounce of Cointreau and 1/2 ounce of fresh lemon juice for all of the golden stuff going on. Shake it all up with ice until your arms feel like you've been building a tabernacle all day, or until it's chilled, whatever comes first. For a non-alcoholic version, we're going with 2 ounces of unsweetened black tea, 1 ounce of orange juice, and the same 1/2 ounce of lemon juice. Either way, strain into our martini glass. Depending on your sweet tooth, you may want to rim the glass with sugar. This isn't the real tabernacle, and I'm not God, so you can kind of do what you want. So, if you choose to do so, do it before you make the drink by rubbing a bit of lemon juice on the rim and dipping it into sugar. Regardless of your alcohol and sugar choices, garnish with a cover of dolphin skins, or, barring that, a lemon twist will do nicely. And, as always, l'chaim.
L'chaim. That's awesome. I will caution our readers, if we may be building a drink inspired by the Mishkan, but don't go looking in the depths of that glass for God, because therein lies madness. No, but I love also what you're saying. There's the cubits, etc. So like the cubit, which is the amma, which is the from the elbow to the fingertips. And I'm thinking about like shake it with your amma, right? And then amma and a tefach. We should do these like different drink measurements. So the tefach is the width of your fist, and I think it's the agudah or aguto that's from your the fingertip to the first knuckle. So you could be like, a 2 agudot pour, right? Which is the equivalent of like a 2-finger pour. But the beauty of that is that, the reason that it was impossible to follow as a building standard is because obviously everybody has different dimensions, right? So like we need a standardization. But for this, it's actually perfect because a drink made according to your own body dimensions is probably going to be the ratios. I would say we're probably going to be tailored very nicely to you.
I feel like, and Amanda, this is kind of a meta thing, but I feel like we keep being given really great things to put on drinking and droshing merchandise. Available now or not yet at store.drinkinganddroshing.com.
I can honestly say that I have been rapt with attention with my whole body. And I know that you can't see me because this is a podcast, but Yoshi could give a thumbs up as well that like I've been sitting forward, with my hands under my chin, like eyes like totally locked in. And right now my body is sad because we've hit our kind of closing section, which is crazy, but we are at thank yous and closing cues. And so for our last question, a really important question has been, playing on my mind recently. And so Yoshi, Gabe, Idan, in order to create a blueprint for the ideal dwelling place, everyone needs to play a part with either a plan, a skill, a gift, some kind of offering. For those who might think, I'm not Jewish enough to insert thing here, how might they still be able to share their offerings in order to build a modern day tabernacle, whatever that might mean to you? Yoshi, we'll start with you.
Yeah, so 2 things. Number one, even or especially if you don't think about yourself as someone who is, an embodiment person, right? Which I understand, right? Again, we all have bodies and we all have things happening in our bodies. So I really invite and encourage you to just start to pay a little more attention to what's happening in your body, right? Our bodies are these deep sources of just data, right? And so you might be reading a book, you might be watching, you might be in the middle of a meeting. Your body is telling you things that if you pay attention to them, sometimes they can be helpful, right? Sometimes your body is saying, I really want to be somewhere else. And then that's where we get the discernment of like, oh, this is an important meeting and I should not get up and leave right this minute. But like, that's helpful information to know of like, oh, maybe something's happening in this space right near that my body is sort of is responding in this way. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, how might you be able to share your offerings? Bring your body to places. Like, show up, kind of sometimes easier said than done, but there are so many things that have happened both for me, just like professionally, but also things that I feel proud of being able to be a part of that happened just because I started showing up, right? Like bring your presence into the space, whether it's this explicitly Jewish space or informal or whatever it might be, like bring your body there and show up. And that includes virtual, by the way. I count virtual spaces as showing up. I spoke earlier about this idea of dwelling of God, the divine soul dwelling in our bodies, of dwelling in the sukkah. This is one of our core teachings at Mitsui Collective, which is the sukkah, and then we can extend this to the Mishkan, represent the dimensions of space-time. And they're actually, and there are seven dimensions. The six dimensions are north, south, east, west, up and down. Think about the six sides of a cube, right? So those are six dimensions. By the way, that's also the directions that we shake the lulav, also connecting to Sukkot, the bundle of plants that we use to make this fun, cool rain dance. I said there were seven dimensions, right? What's the seventh dimension? That's the center. That is you dwelling in the sukkah. That's the seventh dimension, which we call the sacred center, right? And that's when you get to make the blessing. Seven is a number associated with wholeness and completion. And so a space is not as complete without you in it. Anytime you go to a place, enter a space, dwell in that space, you, by definition, make it more whole and more complete. It would not be the same without you. So that is my offering to everyone, is that your offering is to bring yourself, be present, be part of a space, jump in, and then see what happens from there. And once you've found a place for yourself on the inside, turn around, open that door back up, and make sure that others can come in as well.
Well, I just love everything about that. Mostly because that tends to be how I also try to give back, is whenever I can. I really do try to show up. And so thank you for that. Gabe, my friend, what say you?
I think that, you know, if you're thinking I'm not Jewish enough to X, I hope you listen to more of this podcast, A, because we really try to, you know, put front and center, there is not only one way to do Jewish. There are so many ways to do Jewish. And I think, you know, the more you get involved, but also the more you explore, different Jewish communities, different Jewish organizations are doing incredibly interesting things. Find something that interests you and go from there. You know, you gotta start somewhere. So eventually, sure, step out of your comfort zone, go somewhere you're not really sure you're gonna enjoy it, you're not sure you're comfortable. But there are Jewish organizations and Jewish communities that cater to so many different areas of interest and ability and background. And I would really recommend find your people and then go from there.
Well, speaking of finding my people, Idan, what do you have to offer to this incredible conversation?
Well, as I tend to need to write out what I'm going to say so I don't forget it and so that I have the thoughts fresh, it felt like a lot of what both Gabe and Yoshi were saying kind of reflected a little bit in what I had in mind. But to be honest, I kind of had a version of this conversation with a random Seventh-day Adventist Lyft driver who picked me up from the synagogue I work at. He picked me up on a Sunday and was asking me if this was a church. I said, it's a synagogue, blah, blah, blah. He starts talking about what it means to be religious, Jewish and Christian, Seventh-day Adventist. I know nothing about that. And the long and short of it is that even if it feels like there are rules that dictate whether or not you're Jewish enough to blank, if you feel connected to your Jewish self, then you are Jewish, period. The only thing left to do after that is to find your community, whether that be local, online, what have you, and be an active member of it.
I really appreciate that, Idan, as well. Thank you. I would say, especially because one of the things that we've learned through building out this podcast, and I think all of us have spoken to this in some ways, is the ability that when you show up and you are able to really embrace and encourage each person to share their gifts and their talents and their importance, that you come up with something magical. You know, for me, I'm not sure I have so much more to add, except maybe just always remember there's an opportunity to shine a spotlight on someone else's excellence. You know, to really ensure that people know that the way that they live their lives can be really meaningful and impact others. And that you too, when you speak, when you act, when you think, when you embrace, or when you keep yourself distant, you know, that also has an impact on the world that you're creating. And that every place that you exist in has the ability to be a holy dwelling space. Like, I would say this has just been an incredible conversation, and I know I'm tripping over my words because I have so much that I'm thinking about. Yoshi, if people want to continue the conversation with you, how can they best find or follow you?
I would love for people to stay in touch. You can follow our work of my organization, Mitsui Collective, at mitsuicollective.org, on social media at Mitsui Collective. We're mostly on Instagram and Facebook. And you can follow me personally. I do have a website, yoshisilverstein.com. It needs a little bit of updating. But you can also follow me, particularly on Instagram, at yoshimatsa. There's a whole long story I won't tell right now about how that screen name came to be, but I like to say it's like, just as screens are flattened 2D-ish versions, and matzah is a flat 2D version of bread, that's sort of my the flattened digital version of me is Yoshi Matzah. and there's my pun to, you know, finish us up.
Incredible. Thank you so much, Yoshi, for joining us. Thank you, Gabe, for an extraordinary rundown. I mean, so much detail in so little time. And of course, for creating kind of a choose-your-own-adventure midrashic mixology today. That was really exciting. Thank you, Idan, for just making the text sound beautiful, but also for making sure that I don't get lost too often, whether it's in person or in my thoughts. Thank you so much to Mike for editing and making us all sound brilliant. We are so appreciative of you, as always. And thank you to all of our listeners for listening in and, you know, sharing your own gifts with us. We always love to hear from you, and we're always happy to have you be a part of the conversation. We hope all of you are doing well. Stay tuned for the conclusion coming at you soon.
So, there's this idea that Plato came up with that learning information isn't actually adding anything, it's unlocking things. So basically what Plato said in this kind of philosophical idea is that humans are born with all intellectual capacity, all knowledge already inherent within us. And so when we're learning things, we're not actually adding information to our brains, we're uncovering information, we're unlocking it. And so when we bring that idea into Judaism, what we see is that there are these moments of anamnestic experience. That's what we call it in like kind of liturgy terms, is that when we have these moments where we are supposed to feel like we have been somewhere before, like we did this before, even when we didn't necessarily, like how we all stood at Sinai, or when we say, Bechol dor vador, chayav adam lirot et atzmo kiluhu yatsami mitzrayim, that we're all supposed to feel as if we personally came out of Egypt, even though we didn't literally. These are moments of anamnestic experience. Are you with me so far?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm going to laugh and maybe make a silly response, but I would also say Play-Doh is also a way that we use our somatic experiences to build new worlds and make meaning out of them.
Absolutely. It absolutely does. And I loved Yoshi's focus on the somatic, the embodied experience, because it reminded me of these moments in Judaism that aren't really embodied, but really are supposed to be almost like they are. Ki'ilu hu yatsami mitzrayim, as though we came out of Egypt. That was an embodied experience that we didn't have, and yet we're told to feel like we did. That's a perfect example of an anamnestic experience.
Okay, so I do get that, right? Like, it's as if we had been there, but not like kind of the joke of like you had to be there jokes, which are like not very funny because, you know, you don't really get what's going on. But here that you're actually imagining yourself as part of the story. So fun thing about this, talking about bodies and the way that we relate to people. Do you know that when someone's telling you a story that we have what's called synaptic mirroring, and that we actually start feeling the experiences of the person telling us the story? So if somebody's talking about running late and they were really anxious because, you know, they thought they'd get in trouble for being late for their meeting or for their class, we actually, our heart rate starts to speed up and our bodies start to tense in anxiety because we imagine ourselves as the main character in the story they're telling. And so I think it's something like that. I think I get it. But really what it comes down to is this idea that we feel these things in our body and our bodies maintain the history of what's going on. So we have this knowledge within us that connects to knowledge from way, way, way back. And it's up to us to kind of unlock those experiences and share them with each other moving forward. So So I think I get it. And I think that's kind of a cool thing that we do each week, and something that we're able to bring these stories and our lived experiences into the podcast each week, and how people live slash do slash choose Jewish. And that's kind of a cool thing, especially if you're just curious about what our Torah portions teaching or how we might be able to explain it in different ways. And hey, just a quick reminder, this is an excellent, excellent episode on Terumah, but we have others, and we have other ways of having looked at it in the past. So we've looked at it through an architect lens, and we've looked at it through a student Israel advocate lens, and it's kind of been a really incredible way to say, like, hey, what gifts do we have to give, and how can we play a part in the community that builds it? We are so thrilled to have you be a part of our community and, of course, to be a part of yours. And we hope that you'll come visit us at www.drinkinganddrashing.com to look at many of our episodes and see what might work for you. We also invite you to, of course, check out our store, because as Gabe said, we're always trying to come up with new merch that'll be interesting. And we've had some incredible insights from guests that have given us some new taglines. So check us out. You never know. You might want to give some people some Purim presents soon. We wish you the best of luck, and we lift up a glass to you tonight saying L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Yoshi Silverstein, and you're listening to Drinking and Drashing, Torah with a Twist. And this is a reminder that if your body knows how to do something, your mind will follow.